Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my guest is Stephen Greenblatt. He's written a book called The Swerve, How the World Became Modern. And it is about that moment in the Renaissance when things were never going to be the same, largely because a book hunter seeking antiquities in the monastery libraries where you could still find manuscripts had found De Rerum Natura by Lucretius, and really what follows is the Renaissance as we know it. Tell me how you first found Lucretius.
Michael, I first found Lucretius in a much less romantic way. I was an undergraduate at Yale. I went at the end of the year, as I usually did, to the campus bookstore to see what books were on sale for next to nothing, and I was rummaging through a bin and saw that for 10 cents I could buy a copy of a poem I had never heard of by someone I had never heard of, Lucretius's On the Nature of Things. I was attracted to it because it had a cover designed by Max Ernst, the surrealist painter. It showed two pairs of legs, disembodied legs, up in the sky doing something unusual. And I thought, oh, this is an interesting cover, and it would be worth a 10-cent investment. And sometime over the summer, I wasn't assigned. This was not part of the organized pleasure or misery of being a student. Just sometime over the summer, I picked up the book to see what I had bought, and I started to read it, and I was amazed. And it stayed with me really ever since, for decades, as one of the wonderful, eerie reading experiences that one occasionally has in life, where you open a book and it seems to be written for you, speaking to you in an unbelievably direct way, in this case across 2,000 years.
And you say that in a way he was speaking to you as a remedy to the way your mother spoke to you.
Well, that's true. In my case, of course, everyone comes at things through his or her own peculiar personal experiences. I happened to grow up in the shadow of fear of death, not fear of my own death, but my mother's terrible anxiety about dying, which she had all the lifetime that I knew her from my earliest childhood on, probably went back to the death of a younger sister of hers that had traumatized her, scarred her terribly. But she was quite convinced that she was destined for a very early death, and I lived my life in the shadow of this wonderful, loving person. My mother was a marvelous person in innumerable ways, but she had this terrible fear, and she shared that fear more or less constantly. And as a child, it weighed on me, and then I opened a book that said in unbelievably direct and beautiful and compelling ways, death is nothing to us. Death is nothing to us. That's the center of Lucretius's pastoral vision. There are reasons that we can, in the nature of the universe, lift ourselves out of anxiety about extinction.
He's a Roman poet, and he says death is nothing to us. If there are gods, they are indifferent to us. What we do is of none of their concern. Why would they be interested? So he frees us to live our lives as the Epicureans recommend, to maximize pleasure and to turn away from pain.
That's exactly right. Of course, not everyone would find that message particularly consoling. Lucretius's contemporary Cicero said, in effect, though perhaps not with my Woody Allen accent, that's the good news, the good news that we don't have anything to look forward to after death. And yes, that is the good news for Lucretius, along with a lot of other things, that you don't have to feel either anxious or disenchanted about this. It just means that you focus on the pleasure and the wonder of the fact that you exist at all. It's such an odd thing to have happened that the atoms have come together to make Michael Silverblatt or Stephen Greenblatt or any other person in the world. You take pleasure in that as best you can, and you maximize that pleasure and you minimize the pain.
Now, insofar as we've had Lucretius to guide us, he was a great influence on Michel de Montaigne, the great inventor of the essay form, who in his notes tried to imagine the Lucretian version that would allow the atoms to reform into another Michel de Montaigne someday. We have Freud. We have many, many writers, Darwin, who would not exist unless someone had been reading Lucretius.
Yes, I think that's true, though, of course, only in the very peculiar sense in which changes happen in human spirit and in human thought. That is to say, very rarely in a kind of one-for-one directness, but more through the very complicated sinuous routes that things that people release into the world, in this case Lucretius writing 50 before the common era, disappearing, coming back, then is like the butterfly wing in chaos theory that turns out in the long run to determine the direction of the typhoon that hits thousands of miles away. So Darwin is – there's an eerie resemblance between Darwin's thought and Lucretius's, but Darwin didn't learn the principle of natural selection from Lucretius. He learned it from the voyage of the Beagle. And yet behind that voyage and what he's noticing and what he's putting together, somewhere behind that lies a moment 2,000 years before in which Lucretius says there are random – he didn't use the word mutations, but there are random inventions on nature's part. And if those random inventions lead to species that are able to find food for themselves and reproduce, those species will last for a while. And if they don't, the species won't last.
Now, the amazing thing is that he did this, which is a work of philosophy and a work of natural science and a work of aesthetics. He did it in poetry. He did it in the formal hexameter that Latin poetry was in at the time. It's the same that Virgil uses. And he writes, well, an impassioned language. It's as beautiful as Keats. When you're looking for models of beauty in the English language, Keats is where you land. And when you read this, you think, isn't that extraordinary that someone is writing philosophy, rhyming in poetry at such a level of earnestness and revolutionary candor? There's nothing really like it in our own poetry, is there?
There isn't, and there probably wasn't in their poetry either. Way in the background is the Greek philosopher Empedocles, who wrote his philosophy in the form of poetry, but Lucretius was a disciple of a Greek philosopher Epicurus. Most of Epicurus is gone. Most of it is lost. But among the very few sayings that survive that are attributed to Epicurus is the saying, "I spit on poetry." That is to say, Epicurus was determined to express his vision of the universe in plain, unadorned prose. And Epicurus left that as his legacy. Lucretius was a passionate disciple of this philosopher and yet made the extraordinary decision to write 7,400 lines of exquisite hexameter verses. Why? He does it for many reasons, perhaps. We don't know all the reasons, but the reason that he says, and it's probably worth taking seriously, is that it's the way in which a physician smears honey around the lip of a cup to make the patient be able to swallow something that might otherwise taste too bitter, too disagreeable.
I'm talking to Stephen Greenblatt about his book, The Swerve, How the World Became Modern. And what we follow here is the end of the Roman Empire, of Roman civilization, the disappearance in that catastrophe of books, of manuscripts, of bound things into monastery libraries where they also frequently turn into dust before they get copied. And they're not the first candidates for copying. Because the works are frequently pagan, what's copied first are the writings of the church fathers.
There was a moment, the culture could never have imagined it happening when it was at its most vigorous, but there was a moment at which the public libraries were all shut down, private libraries were dispersed to the winds, the owners of the estates were taken off into slavery, a group of people who were fundamentally uninterested in books were illiterate or hostile to the old Roman educational system took over, and the monasteries were the only places virtually in that culture in which at least a small percentage of the legacy of the ancient past could survive.
Now we're in the end of the year 1417, and there are people who call themselves humanists, and their perceived goal is to recover as many texts as possible.
And the person I'm interested in was the most famous, the most successful book hunter of the 15th century, a man named Poggio Bracciolini. A nobody, came from a little town called Terra Nuova. His father had to run away from his creditors in the town at a certain point. But Poggio was a young man. He was born in 1379, so this would have been in the 1390s. Came with 5 pennies in his pocket, as he put it, to Florence, but with one huge, huge advantage. He had magnificent handwriting. This seems like a very strange, outside of the Pirates of Penzance, a very strange possession that would be fungible, but it was tremendously important in this period because the Chancellor of Florence, who was a highly cultivated man who had known Petrarch, corresponded with Petrarch, that chancellor was looking for young men with ability, with intelligence, and with good handwriting. Enter Poggio. And that Poggio gets the impulse to try to find these old books.
And this was one of the ways, by becoming, say, a notary, developing your handwriting, that someone not of an aristocratic background could enter the world.
Yes.
Could be significant. And this Poggio was a secular notary in the Vatican court.
Yes, he didn't want to stay in Florence, though he could have done so. He was more ambitious than that. He wanted the equivalent of the job that ambitious young people wanted a certain moment at Goldman Sachs or at McKinsey, and in the most overheated moment of the 1980s, let's say. He wanted the big job, which was in the Vatican. He managed to get this position working as they called it apostolic scriptor, that is to say a copier of documents, where you could actually make not a huge sum of money, but serious money. He would have made more money had he decided to become a priest. He knows that. But he said he didn't have the vocation for it. He had a mistress with whom he had 14 children, but that wouldn't in itself have kept him from being a priest, of course. But he didn't feel inwardly that was something he wanted. And instead, he stays as a secular person in the court and begins to rise slowly in the hierarchy of the Vatican court.
Now, help situate me. Any book lover who lives in a major city now in America, whether it's New York or Los Angeles, looks around and sees that the bookstores, both the new bookstores and the used bookstores, are closing all around us. The libraries are cutting back their hours, and it's hard for a city on the verge of bankruptcy, or even a well-to-do city at a time of economic crisis, to maintain the libraries. So he's in a state like ours. And this young man, after working for the most famously corrupt pope of his or perhaps any time, is fired in the wake of the pope's dismissal, has time on his hands, and he's essentially making his way into these monastery libraries and essentially having to inveigle and trick the monastic leaders into letting him copy not the text about the saints' bones and not the 18th commentary on the Epistle of the Apostle, but the pagan, beautiful, poetic text, which would otherwise be lost entirely to culture.
Yes, what's odd about Poggio is he found a way. Of course, he had spent his life in a very complex, deeply cynical dangerous world of the Vatican court. He found a way of maneuvering in that world. He didn't like monks as a group. We know this because he wrote a very vigorous and unpleasant satires of monks. He wrote actually also the most famous joke book of his age. He was famous for it. I mean, the Facetiae, it was called. Most of the jokes really can't be repeated on the air, and their objects are priests and nuns and the popes and so forth, many of whom he knew. He's very cynical, but he has one piece of him that is not swept up in this pervasive, soul-destroying cynicism, and that is this dream of finding things from what was, in his view, once a better, clearer world. And in the strange situation that he found himself, out of work for a moment, not knowing quite what to do with himself, he went to the bath, actually. He had some rheumatism in his hands, and he went to the baths at Baden-Baden to see if he could cure himself. And then he found his way to a succession of monasteries where he imagines and then turns out he succeeds in finding things that no one had seen for 1,000 years.
There are those of us, I am among them, who believe that we live at the verge of a new dark age. And what we're talking about with Stephen Greenblatt, who is the author of The Swerve, How the World Became Modern, it's published by Norton, is about the great moment in the Renaissance where we exited, where we watched a dark age come to an end. The Renaissance gives birth, of course, as we know, to Botticelli, to Shakespeare, to so many figures, and it takes up as these lost manuscripts enter the culture, provide a model for what would be poetic forms. Formalism returns. All kinds of springtime re-enter thought, and it becomes possible to contradict the teaching of church fathers who've only been interested in collecting money for pardons, you know. The end of the age of corruption, it's what we look forward to. It's what makes The Swerve, How the World Became Modern, a parable, I think, of what we yearn to face in the near future, the return of a culture that has been losing itself.
One thing, if that's true, Michael, one thing that's strange about this particular return about which I'm writing is that in 1417, when Poggio put his hands on this remarkable poem by Lucretius and decided to recirculate it in the world, he decided to recirculate the following set of principles, that the world consists of atoms and emptiness and nothing else, that there is no creator of all of this, no intelligent design, no providence, no grand scheme, no world in which humans are the most important and only thing that really matter in the world, no afterlife, no thought that the soul will exist, and no politician in the United States, Democrat or Republican, could run on that platform, even though many of those principles in that platform actually turn out to have been the enabling principles of scientific rationality as we now understand them.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Stephen Greenblatt, author most recently of The Swerve, How the World Became Modern. We'll continue after this short break.
I'm Connie Alvarez, producer of Bookworm. Check out our other KCRW programs in the podcast section of iTunes. Shows like DNA, Good Food, The Treatment, Unfictional, and The Business. Or listen on KCRW's smartphone apps. And thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Stephen Greenblatt about his new book, The Swerve, the true story of the historical detective work that uncovered the thousand-year-old poem that shook the early Christian world and marked the beginning of the Renaissance. The poem opens with a tribute to the goddess Venus, the goddess of love, which inspired Botticelli's famous picture painting of Venus rising on the foam of the water in her clamshell. And it goes on to contain some of the most beautiful passages. Yeats said that one of the most beautiful and explicit passages in poetry about desire and its unfulfillability is to be found in Lucretius. Let's hear it.
Yes. Let me just say as a background to this for a second that the problem for the Epicureans, for Lucretius, is that you have a world in which you say that pleasure is the highest good, that this is there's nothing greater than this for a human being. On the other hand, they noticed, as who doesn't notice if you live long enough, that sexual pleasure is at many moments close to pain. And so they actually had a frustration or unfulfilled longings. They had a problem in their theory. And instead of running away from the problem, Lucretius is a great enough poet and a great enough thinker to actually plunge into it and think about what it means that this thing that is the ultimate experience of human pleasure is also peculiarly marked by the desperate longing that is unfulfilled. Here's a tiny sample. This is in the translation that was done in 1685 by the great English poet John Dryden. When the youthful pair more closely join, when hands in hands they lock and thighs in thighs they twine, just in the raging foam of full desire, when both press on, both murmur, both expire, they grip, they squeeze, their humid tongues they dart, as each would force their way to the other's heart. In vain, they only cruise about the coast, for bodies cannot pierce, nor be in bodies lost, as sure they strive to be when both engage in that tumultuous momentary rage. So tangled in the nets of love they lie, till man dissolves in that excessive joy.
That is a section, as translated by Dryden, of Lucretius's De Rerum Natura. We're talking about the idea that in the absence of anything else, that pleasure is the highest good. That is to say, if we have been convinced that there is no God interceding in our fate and our future, if we are convinced that there's no destiny written in advance of our following a path, then we find that avoiding pain may in fact be the highest good, and finding pleasure would be cognate with that. We're not talking about living a life in which we disregard others for the sake of our pleasure. We're not talking about soulless hedonism. We're talking about soulful mindfulness of beauty, of transience, of all the things, in fact, that make poetry poetry.
Yes, that's absolutely true. There was a period, a long period of time, in which principally Christian polemicists needed to argue again and again that Epicureanism was a form of pig-like wallowing in crazy pleasures without a brain. But actually, this is not at all what Lucretius or the Epicureans believed. On the contrary, they thought that what you were – first of all, they began with the sense that humans actually are animals like other animals, that we shouldn't think that we're so totally different that from the animals whom we can observe approaching pleasure and avoiding pain. But they also thought that the set of things that were offered as the highest good in their society, military glory, virtue manifested in piety, the thought that you could exceed the body in one way or another, to become a stoical saint, a hero of indifference to pain, that all of these were false ideas for what a human being should be, that whatever we have has to begin and end in the simple fact that we're these creatures who must try to enhance their pleasure and reduce their pain.
I would propose that a reader of the Rerum Natura is going to find joy, that the expressiveness of the poetry, that the poet's ability to express his freedom from ideas about correct behavior, about how you're being judged, about the afterlife and the next world and the heavenly gate and the torture of the souls in limbo. There's so much joy at just the way things are. That is the form of the celebration, and this is poetry at its height, not only as beauty, but as philosophy. Here, exposing, expressing a philosophy of beauty.
Yes, what is remarkable about Lucretius and about the whole lost philosophical world he represents is that he begins with something that looks very, very simple, almost absurdly simple, which is what it looks like if you look in a beam of sunlight, a strong shaft of sunlight from the side, and you realize that it's filled with tiny dancing motes. Now, they understood that those little dancing dust motes were not atoms, but they begin by thinking, what if that is what the world is like, that there's a dance of matter? And as that, it's out of that that Lucretius begins this poem with this celebration of Venus. This is a poem that says you shouldn't pray to the gods because they're not going to do anything for you. But there's a kind of outpouring of gratitude and wonder at the erotic dance of the universe itself.
I've been talking with Stephen Greenblatt, author most recently of The Swerve, How the World Became Modern, published by W.W. Norton & Company. Thank you, Stephen, for joining me.
Thank you very much, Michael.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to Craig Erthein. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.